happier about here. It looks like our projector is back working again, so everything is happy. So I want to talk quickly about some other issues here. So we finished up last class by talking about issues of optimization, issues of abortion, abandonment. But here's another side to this. We often think of abortion as being a pre-birth option being done by the decisions or conscious decision of the woman there. However, there are numerous spontaneous abortions. Now, the numbers on these are a bit hard to really get. In the studies that collect the data, you've got to be careful about this because often this data may be coming out of women who are going to fertility clinics or reproductive clinics because they're having medical problems maintaining a pregnancy to begin with. But still, if we look in the literature, human spontaneous abortions, 30 to 75% of conceptions result in a spontaneous abortion. Some people actually put this number as high as perhaps 85%. Even if it's on the very conservative 30% of conceptions result in a spontaneous abortion, that's still an extremely high number. And here's what's interesting about this. These abortions then are being produced largely, not exclusively, but largely by the mother's own body. One of the interesting things is we don't know a lot about why exactly these happen. The causal mechanisms aren't entirely clear, although a certain amount of it seems to deal with fitness. We've talked about how energetically expensive maintaining a pregnancy is for females. We've talked about issues of investment in the children post-birth and the fitness of an individual child. If it's a low-fitness child, this may not be a good energy investment long-term with respect to your differential reproductive success. The female body actually seems to assess the fitness of the embryo, the fetus, and if it doesn't cross threshold, aborts so that you save the energy and start over. As I said, we don't know all the factors that are involved in this. One of these is human chorionic gonadotropin, HCG. So if the HCG levels aren't high enough, this seems to be a factor. Again, we're not entirely clear why this is a relevant factor, although now quite frequently in many Western industrialized countries, women are tested for their HCG levels, circulating HCG levels during pregnancy as a possible indicator of future problems during the pregnancy. HCG breaks down into progesterone, so hormone, but this is just one of these factors. There's undoubtedly many, many others that are involved. Now, besides factors coming from the fetus itself, we've also got environmental parameters and factors here too. There are going to be environmental constraints. If food resources are low, these drop down during the pregnancy. If the female's fat stores are being depleted, this is again not a good sign that you are going to be able to maintain this pregnancy all the way through to the end. Should you risk that, keep trying to put the energy in, risk your own life by dropping below a critical level, or stop, abort, start over again. Genotypic issues as well. Some women just have more problems maintaining a pregnancy than others. So there are a large variety of issues here. But this is fairly impressive from an evolutionary perspective that as a species here, particularly with respect to the female members of the species, evolved the ability to make these very good optimization decisions in terms of, is this a good energy investment? From a, if you will, human behavioral ecology perspective, this is a very, very impressive bit of evolutionary engineering. Now, so I mentioned that there are going to be issues with respect to the embryo of the fetus that can signal low fitness, low quality. Once the child is born, There are other factors that can be correlated with poor infant quality, high risk for infant mortality. These may be factors that are physical disabilities and or mental disabilities. And again, where we get into this here is you've got the investment. How much energy are we putting into this offspring? What genetic payoff are you going to get? Is this offspring going to survive long enough to actually be able to reproduce? And all of the things being equal, I mean, you can always die from something happening, but is there a high risk of that? Even if they do survive to adulthood, will they be able to have children at that point? Will they be mentally capable of raising children? If all of these are coming back with a maybe not, then this may not be a good investment. All right. Now, one of the very interesting things I've mentioned about this is cultural anthropologists have known this for years, have looked at non-industrialized people's medical knowledge. And it's not structured in the way that, say, Western medicine is. It's not based on causal systems. It's extremely correlational. But if you go in and look at the sorts of correlational information that have been acquired by these, let's just say, tribal groups over the generations, it's extremely impressive. And it's, in some cases, at least as good as correlational findings in Western medicine. Much of birthing is handled in most traditional societies by midwives. So these are women that, if you think about this, if you have a midwife in the tribe, right, she's birthed generations or assisted in the birthing of generations of babies within the tribe. Not only that, she then watches, as do all the other midwives that may be in the tribe, and her apprentices, she watches these babies grow up. It's a longitudinal study, if you will. So if she observes a unusual occurrence with a child's birth, for example, breech birth, we know, Western medicine knows this as well, breech birth, positive correlation with SIDS, sudden infant death syndrome. We don't know why. No idea. But it's a positive correlation. If you've got a breech birth, foot first, greater chances that you're going to have a child dying of SIDS. But we don't know the causal factor. But tribal medical knowledge knows this as well. Now, they don't always contextualize it this way. It might be talked about in terms of demonic possessions, or an evil spell was cast, or the gods are upset, whatever it is. Which does it. But it comes down to the underlying same medical process. Breech birth, increased risk of this child dying before it's a year old. Is that a good risk? If you've got an increased chance this child's death, should you just abandon it now? Or do you take the chance that 8 months down, after going through the 80,000 calories of gestation and another probably about 80,000 calories by, well, maybe 65,000 calories, by that point, to get to 8 or 9 months of age, do you risk that? Do you risk losing all that, or do you stop at this point, recoup what you can? So these become questions. So, you know, some of these disabilities that are identified and have been looked at in tribal groups by cultural anthropologists, some of them are fairly minor, but they're still noticed. Cleft lips, these kinds of things. Can lead to increased chances of death. Again, correlational. Don't know why it happens, but then neither does a lot of Western medical science, for that matter, either. We use a lot of correlational results in Western medicine, too. But they notice this. And so if the midwives are doing this, over generations of midwives, you get a large body of data built up. And again, because, I mean, you know, this doesn't happen in the West. If you go to a hospital, have your kid, you've got your pediatrician there, the pediatrician follows the kid for a few years, you know, birth, and that's it. Then you go to a grown-up or an older child doctor or a grown-up doctor, and you don't track this in the same way. Pulling all these records together from different doctors' offices, it can be done, but people don't really usually do it. If you're living in the community, if you're watching children from birth adulthood to death, maybe they don't make it to adulthood, and start to acquire these correlational results. So there's some interesting things there. And again, it's valuable. It's necessary. You know, if you're living in that kind of possible threshold environment, these are significant concerns. And again, people that exist in more tribal structures today, going into the back into the EEA, I'm in no way suggesting that they actually thought about this in terms of, what's my energy budget? This will be 65,000 calories of investment into this child, but it could... thinking like that. But we talked earlier about issues of frequencies. Right? We're not good at dealing with probability values so much, Bayes' theorem and whatnot, but we're pretty good at coming up with the frequency of something happening. Well, this has happened to several people in the tribe in the past. Their babies were born breech, they died. Don't know about that. Okay, so interesting things there. Remember Fisher? Good old Ronald Fisher from sexual selection discussion there. He's back again. Along with writing on sexual selection, this ties into it as well, Fisher was interested in sex ratios. Fisher realized males are cheap and expendable. All you need is some sperm. It's the females that are investing a lot. So based on this, one argument could be made that you really don't need very many males. Why do we have roughly a 50-50 split in terms of sex ratios? From one perspective, this seems extremely non-economic. It would be better to just have a very few males that could fertilize large numbers of females, and that would increase the numbers of the population much more rapidly. And so Fisher took a look at this, and he said, okay, well, let's actually assume that we have this sort of thing happening. Let's assume that we get to a point where we've got a strong imbalance. So we've got very few males. So for whatever reason, genetics, some mutations such that only a few members of the population can actually produce sons. Okay? So male births are infrequent. What this means then is if most of the population is just producing daughters, any family that's producing sons, their sons are going to find lots and lots of mates. They will have no problem finding mates. In fact, they will be able to get the best females for their sons to mate with. Now, lower quality daughters then may not be able to find males. May not be enough males to support the offspring, these sort of things. So, families that have females are just producing females are a bit of a disadvantage. Those parents that produce sons will have more grandchildren. But once this starts to happen then, right? So the parents that are producing sons, and just assume they have some genetic reason why they're producing sons and others aren't, well, what happens to those boy-producing genes? Well, they're very rapidly going to start spreading through the population. And after not too many generations of this, now we're going to have way more sons being produced than daughters. Now we get a reversal. Now there's not enough girls, not enough females for the sons, the boys, the grown up to be adult males, to mate with. There's an abundance of males. Now the families, the parents that are producing daughters, now they can pick and choose. No. We're only going to allow our daughter to mate with the best males. Now who's producing more grandchildren? Well, now the families, the parents that, for whatever, let's say, hypothesized genetic reason, said Fisher, are producing daughters. Well, again, after a few generations, then, we're going to start to see a shift, and the genes for producing daughters are going to start increasing. Now, Fisher said, okay, so very hypothetical here, but you can see, over a number of a large number of generations, you would expect this to kind of balance. Instead of going through these wild shifts from producing one sex to the other, sooner or later you would expect these things just to kind of balance out, such that you have about half of conceptions leading to males, half of conceptions leading to females. It seems to be what happens there. So he says it's a feedback loop. Fisher was very big on feedback loops, right? saw that from our sexual selection discussion there. So he says, you know, given time, you should get something around a 50-50 split. Is it the most, if an engineer was going to set it up this way, would they? Probably not, right? Is this the most efficient way of doing things? No, probably not. You have an excess of sons. Not all of them are going to successfully reproduce. But the feedback's probably going to drive it this way into a stable system. Now, Trevis and Willard looked at this a slightly different way. Trevis and Willard said, okay, you know, Fisher's interpretation here, good. Trevis and Willard were doing this in the 1970s. Fisher's doing this back in the 50s. Said, but we don't think it's the case that evolution is going to drive things towards equal numbers of each sex. They said, what we should instead be looking at is what preferences for children of a particular sex occur. And now for most species, non-human species, this is going to be pretty consistent within the entire species because they're limited to a particular ecological niche. In humans, this may be very different because we've got different cultures and different environments and whatnot. But I said, basically, we should be looking at this in terms of a biased sex ratio. Parents then should be either consciously, post-birth, making this decision, or biologically, pre-birth, not making a decision, but having something happen here, based upon the investment. So think about this as, you know, if we think about this in terms of the investment into children of each sex should be balanced against the sex's reproductive, future reproductive potential. So in terms of exactly how this is going to work out, in terms of more males, more females, this really is going to come down to which sex is going to be more reproductively successful. And from the point of view of parental differential reproductive success, that's what becomes important. If having more boys is going to lead to more grandchildren for you, that's the way you should be going. If having more girls, that's the way to go. Now, this is a subtle difference from Fisher. Fisher says you should just achieve a 50-50 balance in males and females. Trivers and Willer is saying you may have that 50-50, roughly 50-50 at conception, but immediately thereafter, selective pressures can come in to shift the sex ratio up to birth and then after birth as well. So here's, for example, how can this happen biologically? Okay, well, we'll talk about the how can this happen after birth fairly. You know, that one's pretty easy to understand. But how about biologically? Okay, large healthy males in most species of mammals and even to some extent within humans. Okay. Probably certainly back in the EEA, larger, healthier males are more likely to mate, more likely to find at least one female, possibly multiple females, to mate with than smaller, less healthy males. Are we okay with that? We can kind of accept that reasoning? Absolute silence, you have no clue? What, you don't like pay any attention to the things going on around you? Apparently not. All right, well, good luck finding people to mate with, people, if you cannot actually work this one out. Sad. Okay, so if a mummy and a daddy love each other very... Thought this would have been covered in elementary school. All right, okay, so let's just go with that, since I'm not getting any feedback from people. Females, though, we have talked about. I mean, unless you've got something extremely wrong, pretty much all females can find some male to mate with. Perhaps not the best male, but let's put it this way, the sort of criteria below which a female has to fall to be unable to find a mate and reproduce and produce children is lower than that the bar, the criteria for males. Tough break, guys. We've got a lot more pressure on us to achieve and show off. Which is why males are more likely to do ridiculous, stupid, dangerous things and all that stuff we talked about before. Okay. Now, let's take this another way here. Healthy females, so healthy women, are likely to produce healthier offspring. Seems, I mean, we talked about spontaneous abortions. If you've got unhealthy female, this may put stress on the pregnancy, maybe aborted, okay, even if it isn't spontaneously aborted, that may compromise the fitness of the developing embryo. So probably safe to say that healthier females will produce healthier offspring. Healthier offspring are more likely to survive childhood, more likely actually grow into large, healthy adults. Okay, so, I mean, this is a correlation, but seems to hold. If you've got healthier, if the baby's healthier, it's more likely to survive and grow up to be a healthy adult. All right. Now, based upon this, Drivers and Willard said, healthy females, then, should produce more males, or boys, than females, girls. Why? Because if you are healthy, if you are a healthy female, your babies will be healthier. If your babies are healthier, they will probably grow up to be healthier, larger adults. Now, that's important if you've got boys. It's not as important if you're producing girls. The sort of, as I said, the bar, the threshold that you have to cross to be able to find someone to mate with is a bit lower for females than it is for males. So if you're going to produce, if you're going to produce males, if you produce a low health male, a boy who's not terribly healthy, odds are it's not going to find someone to mate with in the future. That's a wasted investment. But if you can produce large healthy boys that'll grow up into larger, healthier males, you're likely to get grandchildren out of that child. As I said, with respect to the females, really large, really healthy females, moderately large, moderately healthy females, not a big difference. Okay? Sexual selection criteria there, a bit broader. Less healthy females, though. Let's say you've got a less healthy female. So, produce, you know, somewhat less healthy babies. Well, those are going to grow up to be slightly less healthy adults. Now, if you've had girls, that's not really a big deal. Okay, again, the range for females in terms of health, being able to find mates, broader. But if you're producing unhealthy boys who grow up to be unhealthy adults, probably not going to reproduce, or at least not as successfully. So, Trivers and Willard are arguing, says, yeah, at conception, you may have more or less a 50-50 boy and girl conception rate. But immediately thereafter, all kinds of other factors start coming in and influencing this. So, okay. How could this possibly work? What happens? The mother goes, wow, I'm not terribly healthy. Oh, I just felt a conception. Oh, darn, there's a Y chromosome in there. Delete. Start again. Is that what happens? Well, not quite, but not far off, actually. In utero differentiation comes into play on this. Mothers that are females that are less healthy, so or could be due to poor environmental conditions, whatever. Greater maternal stress. So greater stress on women during pregnancy leads to higher male fetal mortality. Basically, boys are more susceptible to fetal death than girls are. We're more delicate. We're delicate flowers, is what we're saying here. Mm-hmm. Taken care of. All right. So, if you've got maternal stress, a female fetus is more likely to weather that and survive than a male fetus. So there we go. If you've got a lower health woman, if she has a pregnancy that's a boy, more likely to be aborted. Lower health female pregnancy that's a girl, more likely to make it to term. Okay? So lower health females, more likely, again, over at the level of the population, we have lots and lots and lots and lots of births, more likely to produce females than males. Say, any evidence for that? Yeah, actually there is. We actually know about this both from issues of humans and number of non-human species as well. This has been demonstrated. Female stress during pregnancy more likely to lead to spontaneous abortions, losses, premature births of males than females. So this actually fits with the Trivers-Willard interpretation. Okay. So that could be a sort of biological process through which this can be working in terms of adjusting the sexes. And again, it's optimization with respect to, well, in this case, not dads, not the male success, really, because the male produces a, you know, gave his Y chromosome in there, and the boy gets doesn't make it, is aborted. Doesn't really help that much for the male. But it's good for the female. Good for the female. So again, this is an advantage with respect to the sex that is putting the majority of the resources into producing offspring. So parental investment theory here. Okay, so that's a biological system through which the sex ratios could be adjusted post-conception. There's also post-birth adjustment of this, infanticide, culture, environment-specific infanticide. This could be intentional, this could be unintentional. If you've got multiple children, some boys, some girls, depending on the amount of resources, food you've got, we may put more into some of the sexes than others, one sex over the other. Might be unintentional, might be very intentional on the other hand. We probably all know of a wide number of cultures where there is a sex ratio preference. People want more boys than girls or girls than boys. Some of this is due to inheritance. Wealth can only pass through the male line. Others are due to other things. In agrarian groups, it may be more advantageous to have more sons to work the land than daughters. In some groups, in some areas, in fact, actually, if your first child is boy, this is bad. You might abandon that child, hope, try to get the first child being a girl. Why? Because then as that girl grows up, when she passes maybe about age 6, she can start helping the mother with subsequent births. It's called a helpers at the nest. We don't see this, not just humans, a number of birds do this. We've talked about orangutans with this. So in that case, if your oldest child is a daughter, then she can be helping mom with subsequent children, which can increase the success of subsequent birth, survival, reduce interbirth interval. Okay, so some cultures you want a daughter first. So there's all kinds of interesting issues there. A real potential risk is when we very artificially drive this. So probably most of you know about the policy put in place in China in the early 1970s, about the one-child policy, an attempt to lower the birth rate and cut down on overpopulation. The difficulty here is that China, traditionally, culturally, has a very strong bias towards needing at least one male in the family for inheritance and passing on the family name. So what's happening is if parents were producing daughters, they would either be killed or abandoned or put into orphanages. 40 years down the line, we now have in China what are called bachelor cities. These are entire cities of hundreds of thousands of people, 80 to 90% of whom are male. There are too many males in China, not enough females. Unless China starts to adopt a polyandry situation, where women can have multiple husbands, there is going to continue to be some imbalance for quite some time. In fact, now, families that have produced daughters, they're kind of laughing a bit, because I don't want to sound crass on this, but it's come a little bit of a bidding war, right? Why should I let my daughter marry your son? I've got lots of parents who want my daughter to marry their son. What are you going to give my daughter? How good is your job? How stable is it? How big is your house? What resource? How are you going to treat her? I don't know. She's worth a lot now. She deserves the best. Ladies, if you're looking to get a boyfriend or a husband, may I recommend going to China and conducting interviews in the bachelor cities? Next! Thank you for coming by. We'll be in contact. Shred. Right? Got your choice. Okay. It's an artificially imposed structure. This did not develop in a more naturalistic system. It was just imposed. But the other cultural practices that had been developed over many, many, many generations were changed at the same time. China has currently got a bit of a problem about this. China has problems actually about a lot of things. They're actually even just building entire cities that have nobody in them because it's stimulating the economy. So there's cities that could house 500,000 people that maybe only have 40,000 people living in them. So yeah, it's bizarre. But this is what goes wrong with attempts at social engineering, right? It's not quite eugenics in this sense. But I mean, it's the same kind of it's a related issue here. It's sort of a social eugenics. We're going to try to manipulate the whole social, cultural, economic structure of a very large country with lots and lots of people, and trying to predict the consequences, that is, trying to predict the future and where this is going, very, very difficult. And probably ultimately doomed to failure. So, anyways, there's a few other things that we could bring in here. Even if we don't have issues of infanticide or abandonment or whatnot here, there's other things that can affect the adult sex ratio. So you've got your sex ratio conception, pretty close to 50-50. Then you got your sex ratio at birth, could have been influenced by the biological process under which Trivers-Willard talk about. And then there could be differences, even leaving aside, say, abandoning or killing one sex over the other, there could be differences in male-female maturation times. Right? So depending on environmental constraints, access to resources, foods, whatnot, there could be differences in how long it takes to reach sexual maturity for one sex over the other. This can produce differences there. There could be differences in terms of male-female mortality. War comes along, and you're probably going to lose more of the males than you are of the females in your group. Even if it's not a war, if you're dealing with lots of predators in the area. Again, most groups, cultural groups, right, put the males protect the females. Females are a limiting resource. Females are important. Males are, admittedly, somewhat expendable. So females go into the center of camps and whatnot. Males are out in the periphery, even if it's something like roving bands of hyenas that are picking things off, more likely to be picking off the males that are in the guard duty and sentry than the females. So again, there can be differences in mortality. Hunting, right? Hunting's probably more dangerous than gathering. Look out! Rogue carrot! What's it going to tell me? Oh, I tripped over a rutabaga. Darn. Right? As opposed to you tracking the antelope, and the lion's tracking the antelope, and then the lion decides, I'm going to track that primate that's tracking the antelope. Okay? So there can be all kinds of things that can lead to differences in adult sex ratios there. So local resource enhancement. I actually talked about this briefly already. So if one offspring of one sex is going to provide greater assistance to parents in some way, be it in terms of farming or assisting with mom with helping other kids, these sort of things, then again, we're going to get into potential differences in the adult ultimate adult sex ratio here. You may even get into issues where you've got resource competition between the children. So competing for access. This is related to, in nice rich environments like ours, we don't often have children trying to, in the same family, trying to get all the cereal and prevent some other kid from not having cereal. But we often have competition for parental attention, right? So who's going to get the attention from the parents? It's not so much a survival thing, perhaps, but it can come down to parental investment in other ways. So, local resource competition. Okay. I'm going to finish this section, this chapter up by talking a little bit about teen pregnancy. Now, teen pregnancy is interesting, and not in the kind of trashy way that, like, whatever shows like 16 Pregnant, are. I keep saying reality television is interesting because of what it represents, but it's also horrible on so many levels. The fact that you know, people want to watch shows where you've got pregnant 16-year-olds who almost, apparently every episode, is wait for it, will say something like, I never thought it would be this hard, and break into tears, and that's entertainment, is telling, I suppose, about human behavior. Regardless, let's talk about teen pregnancy here. It's interesting. Now, a very sort of traditional mid through late, or even earlier, 20th century approach to pregnancy was that if teens were getting pregnant, it's because they were either stupid and didn't actually understand how you get pregnant, which I find unlikely, but all right, or it was unintended, which I find actually more possible in many cases, but still. An alternate view of this is that teen pregnancies are not either due to just not understanding how you get pregnant or, oops, it broke, but more of perhaps a deliberate attempt to gain access to resources. Now, in some environments, cultures, that could be through various forms of social security, governmental child support, by getting a husband, right? The shotgun wedding. You gone and got my daughter pregnant. You is gonna get married to her. That sort of thing. Is that just like my ancestors that would have those kinds of conversations? Yeah? Okay, anyways, it shows where I come from. Right? So, roping males into marriage this way. But it may more broadly be an adaptive reproductive strategy here. Now, remember, we've talked before about a very interesting thing with mammals, unlike other species, is you have these matrilineal cross-generational bonds. Mom always knows who her kids are, and then always knows, at least in terms of her daughter's children, who her grandchildren are running through her daughter's line. Not her son. Son, you no idea. Okay? We've also talked about how things like menopause, for example, grandmother hypothesis, that by stopping reproduction at one point, you can then shift from direct fitness investment into indirect, so increase your inclusive fitness by assisting raising with grandchildren here. So, female share child rearing. There's been some interesting work done on this. If we take a look at women in lower socioeconomic conditions, relatively poor job prospects, relatively poor marriage prospects when they're young. So for teens and early 20s, the kinds of jobs you can get aren't great, and kinds of marriage prospects may not be great either. But this may improve with age, right? Are you going to hire a 15-year-old to lock up the bank at night? Or maybe 30-year-olds seem to be a little more responsible? Who's going to be the manager of Wendy's? Your 18-year-old or the 30-year-old? Okay, so, with age comes, it's often said there's nothing wrong with youth that age doesn't fix. You get a different perspective on things by getting a little bit older. All right, so, if a girl has her first child at about age 15, okay, then maybe with a several-year interbirth interval, maybe then 19, 18, 19, 22, 23, a bit of this. If we consider over about three generations here, now let's consider three generations. We've got a mother, 15-year-old, so has her first child at 15. The grandmother of the child that's going to be born will now be about maybe 35, so the mother's mother, right? So 35-year-old, 40-year-old, somewhere in there. And then the child is going to also have a great-grandmother, most likely, right? Wow, great-grandmothers are really, really old. Not necessarily, right? Many cultures may only be 50, 55 by the time you become a great-grandmother. Right? If you've got 15 to 20-year-old or 15 to 20-year generation spacing, you certainly still have great-grandmothers who could be around for quite some time. Right? You can get great-great-grandmothers being alive to see the great-great-grandchildren. Okay? So, let's just, you know, and this is the way this interpretation has worked, so let's do this kind of spacing, roughly. You know, the reproductive, the youngest one, the 15-year-old, who's now having a kid, that's our reproductive female. The grandmother of the child, or her mother's mother, going to be 35 to 40, she's going to be, let's say, a worker. And then the great-grandmother, postmenopausal, 50, 55, 60, she's going to be helping with child care. So, female shared child rearing. We've got three women working together to produce the next generation. Okay. Each has got a cost and a benefit to her particular, you know, quote-unquote, job. So, the mother, the 15-year-old, she's sacrificing resource acquisition. She's not going out and trying to find whatever kind of job she could get. She's producing a baby. But she gets something for this. She gets personal reproductive fitness. She gets direct fitness. All right. The child's grandmother, the 35-year-old woman, at this point, she's sacrificing her personal reproductive fitness. Like, right, I'm done having children. She goes out and works. So she's the one going out getting that job. She's bringing resources back into this family unit here. Okay, so she's acquiring resources, and she's gaining inclusive fitness. So not direct fitness. She's stopped reproducing herself, but she's assisting her daughter in producing children. So she's getting indirect fitness there. Inclusive fitness. The great-grandmother, 50, 55-year-old, 60-year-old, she's mostly probably sacrificing resource acquisition, although there could be some sort of small jobs that she's doing locally around the house, sewing, beating, you know, internet sales, whatever. That was probably not internet sales. Okay, so she's mostly stopping with the resource acquisition. She's, at this point, probably postmenopausal, so she's doesn't have the opportunity for direct fitness anymore anyways, but she's gaining still inclusive fitness. She's helping with the child care. And, in fact, by assisting with the child care, this may even reduce those interbirth intervals so you can have a few more children a bit closer together. It's just spacing about 4 years apart, 2.5, 3 years maybe. Okay. So there's costs and benefits to each of the women. It's a partnership, if you will. You go, wow, that's a really nice story. Any evidence for this? Yeah, there is. Sometimes I'll just tell stories, but usually I'll tell stories that actually have some sort of evidence to support them. So, a few studies have been done in rural Trinidad looking at this. Typically, they find, and in fact where this works, they find there's only one reproductive female per a household. They find that the daughters, that's what we'll call the mother in our example, the youngest of the females here, only becomes pregnant after her mom's last child is about 4 years of age or older. Okay? So then she gets pregnant and has a child. What they've also found is it doesn't always work smoothly. Conflict occurs between mothers and daughters if the daughter has reached childbearing age, so she's past 15, 16, 17, 18, and her mom's still having kids. So into her mid-30s, late-30s, and she's still reproducing. Because by doing this, if you're not going to be able to support. Somebody has to go out and make money, bring the resources back in the house, and if mom's still busy having kids, that's not happening. So conflict can occur. But this fits. The Trinidadian research, rural Trinidadian research, fits with the model of how shared female child rearing could be very adaptive. So having teen pregnancies or younger pregnancies could actually be very adaptive. Let's see, anything outside of Trinidad? Maybe Trinidad's just weird about this. Maybe there's, I don't mean weird in that sense, but I mean maybe there's something very locally, environmentally peculiar about Trinidad that we don't see elsewhere. There have been some studies that have found similar patterns in American urban ghettos, so inner city areas where there's not a lot of job opportunity, so low socioeconomics, And in this kind of pattern, not perhaps quite as distinct as seen in Trinidad, but we see similar sorts of patterns there as well. Multiple generations of women working together to raise the next generation, the youngest generation. So in some cases, perhaps under low resource availability, in at least a somewhat agrarian type setting, part of what I should say here is, in, for example, in Trinidad, you say, where are all the guys that are getting these girls pregnant and the mothers pregnant? What's happening with that? Where are they? They actually often are leaving the rural townships and heading for larger centers where they're trying to get industrial manual labor type jobs. And so sometimes they'll send some resources, some money back home to help with the kids, but it's not something that can be relied upon. Not dissimilar to, you know, urban centers, inner city groupings in the United States. The work's correlational. I mean, for obvious ethical reasons, right? We can't do anything about this. You know, can't just wander into an area and go, right, here's what we're going to do. We've got a 15-year-old. We're going to impregnate her. We're going to get rid of all the guys and go. Okay, so we're stuck with correlational data here, but it's interesting. It's intriguing. There are, however, some questions about this. So if we were to take this back into the EEA, and this actually becomes an interesting one. Would this have worked in the EEA? Or are we seeing something that has evolved sort of post-EEA, which becomes very interesting with respect to, say, the Santa Barbara School's thought that we've got all this Pleistocene stuff that we carry over and not much has happened evolution-wise since. But here's the thing. If you're back in the EEA, and we think most of the humans that lived back before 10,000-odd years ago were pretty migratory, tribal, nomadic. They'd wander around a bit. They'd stay as kind of a tribal unit. Yes, the men would probably go out and hunt, but then they'd come back. Well, instead, what if we've got a situation here, rural? So we've got early agrarian, perhaps. Now, if you're not tied down to the land, probably everybody in the group, men and women and children, all sort of move along together. But once you hit some sort of early agrarian setting where you're starting to farm, okay, maybe the males are off working for somebody else's farm, a larger farm. Maybe they're off moving the your sheep or your goats or whatnot from winter pastures to summer pastures, which may not be particularly close to where you're actually settled, where you're tied to the land. Okay, so maybe this is actually a pattern in terms of this that has developed post those early agrarian periods. We don't tend to see this in modern, you know, the few remaining existing tribal, you know, pre-industrial tribal groups that are there. We do see shared female child raising just because everyone's in close proximity, but we don't necessarily see the age divisions in terms of things. So there's interesting issues there. But one question is, how is reproduction regulated? So there's conflict when the 35-year-old keeps having kids into her 40s. So how's that done? What if you have multiple daughter families? The 15-year-old and then the 11-year-old daughter. Well, by the time the 15-year-old hits 19, she's probably on to her second kid, and now your 11-year-old hits 15. That should be the time she's having her first. How many children can you actually support with this system? How's that dealt with? Historical evidence. While we're seeing examples of this in modern Trinidad and inner-city America, perhaps that's due to modern economics, modern socioeconomic restrictions. I mean, talk about, you know, getting a job. Well, back in the EEA, nobody went off and got jobs, per se. I mean, there wasn't an economy. Well, there were economies, but they were very, very different in scale. That's interesting. We actually aren't going to have a chance to talk about this, but, you know, you wonder about things like economics. Are our economic systems, monetary systems, completely modern? Monetary systems are quite modern, but the concept of economics with respect to trade, that's ancient. We know, for example, that there was a North America, Central America, and even spreading into some of South America wide trade network. Resources, for example, that could only have come from things like the Gulf of Mexico have been found by archaeologists working in Alberta. So it's not that things got transported directly from the Gulf of Mexico straight up to Alberta, but they'd move through all the various peoples and tribes across North America. So extremely complicated trade networks did exist. So economics, in a sense, did exist, just not in terms of monetary. So if you're interested in economics, there's a fascinating side for, you know, evolutionary economics as well. And what does that say about how modern economic structures work? And why do we, as humans, make certain types of investments and not others? Anyways, so, you know, what's the historical evidence for this? Is there any? Can we say, was this back in the EA? Is this a more modern process? Cross-cultural? Well, so far studies on this have only looked at a few cultures here. Like to see more if it's, you know, if we're dealing with something that's a universal. It says correlational, you know. For obvious reasons, we can't do experiments on this, but one has to be careful with correlational results, right? A theory has been proposed on this, but we've got to be careful that we're getting enough results so we're not just making inferences, okay? Okay. Next chapter takes us. So we've been talking. We were talking in this last chapter a lot about issues of kinship, kin-related processes, these factors. Chapter 8 takes us into reciprocity and group behaviors. So take a look at some things here. Generally speaking, reciprocal altruism exists between non-kin. You could have reciprocal arrangements occurring with, you know, between kin as well, but probably the direct kin-selected altruism are probably more beneficial at that point, more relevant, unless perhaps you're dealing with somewhat distant relatives, cousins, those sorts of things. But usually, when we talk about reciprocal altruism, sometimes also called the Good Samaritan effect, although in the literature, scientific literature, you'll generally just see it called reciprocal altruism, we're generally talking about arrangements that are occurring between non-relatives. And what happens is an individual sacrifices resources, expends a cost now for the possibility of a future return. Okay? For reciprocal altruism to have evolved, a few things have to be, we think, have to have been met. First, the cost of the donor has to be less than the benefit to the recipient. Second, recognition of individuals. Third, long-ish lifespan. You have to be around long enough to actually get reciprocity there. Now, for a long time, really, certainly through into the 1950s, and still many people argued this into the 1960s, it was felt that reciprocal altruism was something unique to humans. Only humans are either cognitive enough or moral enough or blah, 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 to be able to do this. Well, it turns out, actually, there was plenty of non-human evidence of reciprocal altruism. Alarm calls for thwarting predators. Prairie dogs. Anyone been out in the prairies and, you know, watched Richardson ground squirrels or prairie dogs do this? You know, big colonies of ground squirrels running all over the place. One of them, or a few of them, are just standing up tall, looking around. And if something scary comes by, spot a coyote or a hawk, they'll stand there and make these loud, high-pitched chirping noises. And they do that, and all the other ground squirrels, that's the alarm call. So the ground squirrels go, blah, and take off and dive into their holes, run for safety. And whoever's on guard duty stands there for a while longer, making these really high-pitched chirping squeaks. Now, you say, well, isn't that putting that ground squirrel at risk? Yeah. I mean, what is that saying? It's like, hey, predator, here I am. Look at me. Don't look at all the other ground squirrels running away. Notice me. Okay. Yeah. Sentry duty is dangerous. Why does a ground squirrel agree to be on sentry duty? Well, because they trade. They trade off. You don't have to be on sentry duty all the time. You do it for a while, then somebody else does it. So you're sharing. You're sharing the risk. Right? Cooperative breeding. So shared child raising or offspring raising. We see this in many of the social carnivores. We see this in even some other, say, ungulates and herd animals. Food sharing, seen between many species, meerkats, canids, felines, all kinds of colonial-based species here. Dominance, ritualized aggression, can be seen as a form of reciprocal altruism as well. So challenges for hierarchy in wolf packs. Okay, generally this doesn't lead to one wolf killing the other, right? Because, well, they're dead. Okay, but so if one wolf challenges another wolf and wins, doesn't kill the first. Well, first wolf might challenge the wolf again in the future. Okay, you didn't kill me, I won't kill you. There we go. You've just swapped jobs for a while. Okay. We see this in all kinds of species, non-human species, apes, monkeys, wolves, African wild dogs, vampire bats, lots of different species here. So this is not something that is unique to humans. This does not require a higher cognitive or moral reasoning. Take a look at a few examples here specifically. Mating in baboons, so reported by Packer in 1977, found that males, lower-ranked hierarchy males, would solicit help in these what we call conflict situations. So, look, I've talked about baboons a little bit before. Baboons are large, pretty large-bodied primates with a lot of teeth and relatively little brain. They're kind of like Pooh Bear on, you know, Pooh Bear or Bear of very little brain, but he's a nice bear. Baboons, not so much. You know, apes of very little brain. Well, monkeys really, very little brain. But a lot of testosterone and aggression. Anyways, the most dominant male in a baboon troop is generally the biggest, toughest male. That male generally controls access to the females and can usually beat off any other individual male that challenges. So, we've got a lower-ranked male. Lower-ranked male would like to mate with one of the females, but if he just goes over and tries to mate with one of these other females, he's going to get his little red baboon butt handed to him by the dominant male in the troop. Not good. So, he tries to get a helper. So, he establishes eye contact with another lower-ranked male in the troop. So, he looks at the other male, and he looks at the leader, and he looks at the other male, and he looks at the leader. So I got this eye contact, going on sort of thing, okay? And at that point, you know, if this all works out right, now these two lower-ranked baboons go over, beat on the leader, tag-team him, essentially. Leader takes off for a while, and the male that initiated this, that established the gaze contact, heads off and tries to mate with the female, gets the opportunity to mate. Out of 20 cases of conflict like this observed by Packer, he found that in 16 of these cases, there was a helper. And in 16 of these cases, the two baboons were able to beat off, at least for a short time, drive the leader away. Now, in all of these cases, Packer found that the helper doesn't get anything out of it, at least not right then. It's like, oh, so does the male that helped, does he go mate with a female as well? No. Doesn't. But in future, if a helper, somebody that helped, he's got a female, he's got his eyes on there, and if he initiates eye contact with the male that he helped, it's much more likely to get assistance. So, you help me now beat up the leader, I'll help you in the future. Reciprocity. Okay? So, it turns out that males... what Packer calls friendless males, males that refuse to help, are less likely to get help themselves when they ask. So if it's like, yeah, I see you making eye contact with me, but I'm just eating a piece of fruit right now. I don't think so. said, yeah, well, it's like, fine, don't come asking me, well, not asking, don't come looking at me for help later, because you're not going to get it. And that's what happens. Okay, so you help because in the future you may need help as well. Now, I said friendless males rarely mate. So this is actually a beautifully elegant little example of evolution here. So what are you taking out? If you've got males that have some, let's just think there's at least perhaps some genetic predisposition to make them friendless, not help. Well, if those males that don't help don't tend to reproduce, any genes that are contributing to that are not going to be propagated through the population. Who gets to reproduce? The males that help. Those genes, with respect to reciprocal altruism, then increase in the population. So over not too many generations, you've got a large proportion of the population that has these "I will help" genes. Now, I'm not saying there's specific genes for reciprocal, you know, altruism. There's probably all kinds of things that are contributing, you know, a degree of eye contact, a certain amount of cognitive ability ability to remember who you've helped and who you haven't. So lots of things. But let's just lump these under, you know, contributes to the genetics of reciprocal altruism, and we can see how fairly quickly, not too many generations, we could get these characteristics increasing in the population there. All right. Vampire bats. Again, this works much better in fall term when Halloween is coming up, so oh well. We're, you know, try to picture a pumpkin or something up here on the desk, all right? So, and I'll say it this way, bomb by a boss. Vampire bats actually do not exist in Transylvania. Vampire bats, contrary to what the classic and brilliant movie Van Helsing would have you believe, do not drop out of the sky and lift people off the ground, carry them off, and messily devour them. They're actually about this big. Wingspan is something like that. Bodies of about like that. Ooh, terrifying. Yeah. If a vampire bat were to end up landing on your neck, could it kill you? No. Could it suck all the blood out of you? No. Could it suck even a lot of blood out of you? No. Could it suck as much blood out of you as I still have coffee here in my cup? No. Are they scary? No. Do they actually suck blood? No. What? They lick blood. So basically, the vampire bat is, do they feed off people? Maybe occasionally. But primarily they feed off cattle, sheep. So vampire bat, do they always land on the neck? No. They couldn't hang on. Then the sheep just goes stomp on it. No. What they do is they find a sheep or a cow or something that's asleep, or, you know, and they land on the ground, you know, a few meters away and sort of like wing drag themselves towards the sheep or the cow. And they sneak up near to a leg, a hoof or something, and where there's not a lot of hair between the hoof and the skin of the leg, they've got fangs, but they make two little tiny incisions. It's like that. So tiny. I mean, like you're taking a pin and just scrape. And that's how they get their blood. They have to, like, lick at it. There's an anticoagulant in their saliva. So, I mean, it's not like, ha-ha, latch onto the leg, you know, and the sheep goes and falls over. It's like, quietly sneak up, hope it doesn't see me. You know, lick, you know, half hour later, you know, several drops of blood at a time. It's like, oh, I'm full. Must crawl away now. And they have to crawl away, find a tree or something they can climb up to get airborne, usually. A little bit of a drop. Sometimes they can get off the ground, but not usually. Vampire bats. Yeah. I love these things. These are great. But anyways, they have an interesting sort of way of existing here. They do hang out in trees and things, going upside down, and they hunt at night. So in they're South American bat, not Transylvanian. Not uncommon. This is particular trees that they're likely to roost in during the day. And it's pretty common to find up to maybe 12 mothers with their offspring hanging out in this tree. Males, young males, tend to leave fairly early, and they tend to disperse. They fly away from the area in which they were born in. This reduces things like inbreeding, incest, reduces risks of that. But females tend to stay in the territory, the area they were born in. Often, in fact, reusing the same trees. There may be a number of trees in the territory that they'll use. So, in any particular tree. That, you know, imagine you're a vampire bat, a female vampire bat, and any particular tree you happen to roost in overnight, you know, probably 60% of the bats that are hanging out in that tree, you've at least associated with on some night in the past. In other words, you've shared a tree with many of these bats before. In other words, these are bats that you know, insofar as we can think of bats knowing one another. These are familiar bats. Bats get better at feeding over time. There is a learning curve to this. About 33% of yearlings, that is bats less than a year old, would fail to get a blood meal in any particular night, as opposed to only 7% of the bats that are 2 years or older failing to get a blood meal on a night. So they get better. They learn, you know, is that animal asleep? Is it in a good place? Can I sneak up on it? Well, all of this stuff. Okay. You go to bat. Vampire bat school, I guess, to get advanced degrees in sneaking and stuff. They can go 3 days without feeding. After 3 days of not getting a blood meal, they die. They just don't have the energy. They have to get food. That's it. As long as they can go. Now, an interesting thing is that they can regurgitate blood. So if they've got a blood meal in them, they can barf some of it up, and use this to feed another bat. Okay? So, bat friends will vomit blood for other bat friends. If you were really my friend, you'd vomit up some blood for me. You're right. Great. Isn't it nice when you know, perhaps we've forgotten our lunch and you go to a friend and ask if they can cover you for lunch? There's like, yeah, let me just hork something back up for you here. Yeah, that's okay, never mind. Just give me, let me $5, that'd be great. No, I've got something here, hold on. Yeah, bats. Okay, so who's a friend? Well, a friend is a bat that's vomited blood for you in the past, has fed you in the past. It's kind of like our helper baboons here, right? So, now an interesting thing is, bats can tell how far another bat is, and so can humans, as it turns out, if you get used to this. They can tell how far a bat is from starvation based upon, it's called blood gut. So, when the bat feeds, it gets a blood gut. It extends, distends its stomach, manages to get back into the air, flies off to a tree, hangs there, and digests this massive, compared to the size of the bat, relatively massive blood meal. And then as this is digested over the next few days, the blood gut goes down, skinnier and skinnier. And so bats can tell when another bat's within about 13 hours of starvation. And that's a bat that's in need, right? And they tend to only regurgitate for bats that are in need. Okay. But at that point, they're very much in need. If they don't get some sort of blood, they're not going to make it through the next day. We found dead. In fact, as it turns out, most of the bats that are found dead by researchers that work with them are males. You just wander around, you find the trees, and then you look around the base of the tree, and there's some, you know, a dead bat there. Okay? Almost always, it's a male. Why? Why don't other bats regurgitate? Why don't males have friends? Well, because they tend to leave areas. They fly around a lot. They're not related to the bats that are there. So you don't have any kinship connections going on. You don't have mothers helping out there. And, as I said, they tend to move around a lot. They keep looking for new females to impregnate. So they'll move from area to area to area. Now, with respect to reciprocal arrangements, do you want to vomit up blood? Do you want to give a blood meal to a male who's, you know, next week or the week after going to fly off someplace else? Never see him again. Not a good investment. And so, in fact, these are the bats that often die, are the males. You go 3 days in a row without successfully feeding, dead. Okay, so reciprocal arrangements here occur much more between females, which stay in an area. If you stay in the area, you build up these connections. Okay. Chimpanzees and politics. Anyone ever watched, you know, the House of Commons on like Channel 11 or something like that? Yep. Except for not throwing poo, it looks very much like a bunch of chimpanzees in suits. All right. So, I've mentioned this before. Politics is really just behavior of managing social interactions. So, Arnhem Zoo in the Netherlands for years, up until quite recently, in fact, up until about 12, 15 years ago, Arnhem Zoo was the largest captive population of chimps in the world, in the largest facility. They had a, well, still do, Arnhem Zoo has about a 4-acre enclosure. About 1.5 acres of that are sort of covered and not in sight, but the other about 2.5 acres are open, trees, semi-naturalistic. Right? I mean, there's sort of down in a pit, there's a big wall around it so the chimps can't get out, but other than that, within that, it's kind of a foresty type area, so it's not just chimps in cages. And I mean, from the point of view of chimpanzee research, I mean, primatologists would go to Arnhem and study chimps, right? Place to go. There's now a facility down in Florida, which is much larger. I think it's something like about 100 acres. It's fenced off. There's all kinds of blinds and viewing stations that are there that, you know, people can get to and climb up into little sort of towers with little sort of, you know, areas where you can sit and look out at the chimps and film them and whatnot. Let the chimps go about and do their thing. But for years, Arnhem was probably the best place in the world, and unless you wanted to go to Africa, sit out there and watch chimps, the best place to go. So, some data from here. So, there used to be, these chimps are all gone by now, but urine. For years, urine was the dominant male in the of the Arnhem chimps. About, I think it was about 45 adult chimps in the zoo at this point. So urine's dominant. He was securing about 75. In his prime, he was securing about 75% of the matings. Now, I've said that in the past, chimpanzees don't really, they're more promiscuous. They don't really have like a harem structure in the way that, say, gorillas do. So how could he be securing so many matings? Well, in the natural environment, you know, if a male and a female want to go off and mate, and the dominant male doesn't like it, what can happen? Well, they run off into the forest together. Now, the dominant male can chase them, and if he catches them, fine. He can drag beat up the more subordinate male and drive the female back to the group. But honestly, if he has to keep chasing through the forest, the longer he's chasing these other chimps through the forest, what's happening back at the troop? Well, some other chimps going, hey, dominant male's not around, woohoo, going to have sex with some of the females. So it becomes a bit of a risk. So in the natural environment, even very dominant male chimps aren't that great at controlling the matings. They may get more than others, but it's often done by providing more food, meat, to females. In Arnhem, though, if a couple of other chimps, less dominant male and female, wanted to mate, sooner or later they're going to run into the wall. Right, it's only 4 acres, okay, and so urine could catch up with them pretty quickly. Right. Now, urine's getting a bit old as these things happen, and there's a younger subordinate male called Lute who's sort of up and coming. Now, Lute's challenging urine increasingly. He's managed to secure about 25% of the matings. Okay. And gradually what happens is the females defect. The females stop supporting urine, they stop being willing to mate with him, and they shift over to Lute. Now, Lute's not as good at this yet. Lute's only controlling about 50% of the matings at this point, maybe a little bit over. But urine gets cut out. His matings go from 75% down to zero. He's seen as, you know, the old leader. He's gone. Kind of like what happened to Paul Martin, right? Okay. So, again, think about this. Chimpanzees, human politics. It's not very different. Here's where it gets interesting. Yoren hooks up with a younger male named Nikki. So these are Yoren and Nikki. Here's Nikki in the front. Nikki is a very large male chimp, okay? It's kind of hard. He's hunched over, but he's big. Yoren's getting a little bit grayer there, a little bit older, beard a little scragglier, a little smaller there, but Nikki's big. But Nikki's not all that bright, okay? I mean, to be fair, you know, big chimp, not really a very aggressive chimp either, as it turns out. So big, but, you know, not that bright, apparently, and not really all that aggressive, just big. So Yoren hooks up with Nikki. It's kind of like the Pet Shop Boys song, except about chimps, right? I got the brains, you got the brawn, let's have lots of sex, is really what it comes down to. Okay. So Yoren basically acts as the brains of the outfit, and kind of gets Nikki to go beat up on Loot a bit. Right? So working together now, Nikki wasn't getting any of the matings behind. So like I said, you know, big, maybe not that bright, not terribly motivated about stuff, you know, needs a bit of a handler, reminder to tell him what he should be doing there. Nikki goes from getting none of the matings up to about 50% of the matings. Yoren goes from zero up to 25% now. As a unit, they're back up to the 75. Yoren never gets back up to 75. But hey, 25% is better than zero at this point. Okay? So this is a reciprocal arrangement here. Right? They're trading things. I'll help you get more matings, and in return, I get some matings as well. We work as a team. So this is a little bit, I mean, you know, it's, well, you do something now for a future return, but reciprocal arrangements can come in as forms of alliances. So we see this in chimpanzees. You get these male-male alliances. And often in wild chimpanzees, the male-male alliances are based around kinship. Fathers, sons, cousins, uncles, nephews, these sorts of things. Okay? And strong male alliances tend to acquire female support. Right? So then you get male alliances making connections with females. Very interesting issue. As it turns out, males can't really maintain dominance without female support. I mean, this is what happened to Yoren. As the females are looking at this and seeing that Loot is winning more and more of these aggressive confrontations, they start going, you're on the way out. You're gone. Okay? What would happen to Justin Bieber if females just suddenly decided to stop supporting him? Would he still be selling CDs? Would you still download his stuff from YouTube or the iTunes? Is he really that good as a musician? I doubt it. He's not bad, right? But I mean, you know, is he really the young Frank Sinatra? Oh, I don't think so. He's cute. His name sounds like the great Canadian animal on a nickel. What's not to like? Well, until the young women realize he's got a pretty hot girlfriend and he's not actually going to date them.
No.
Ooh, Justin, you made a mistake there. All right. Okay. So, there's some examples of this in non-humans. And there's many, many other examples of reciprocal arrangements in non-humans. They can take lots of different forms. So, why do this? Why engage in reciprocal arrangements? Well, easiest way to explain this is what's called a risk reduction hypothesis. It's a type of insurance. I help you now, and in the future, if I need help, you will help me. Safety in uncertain conditions. A survival benefit. Now, interestingly, looking at a variety of situations, non-humans and humans, we find that incidences of reciprocal interactions increase as the behavioral risk with the group also increases. So groups, environments for which there's high risk, be there environmental issues, instability in terms of food resources, high rates of predation. The greater the risk, the more reciprocal altruistic interactions we see. In safe, stable, low-risk environments, we see less reciprocal arrangements. Think about this, okay? Easy courses where you've got an assignment to do, you do it by yourself, yeah, probably. Engineers, you know any engineers? The kind of assignment, my best friend in undergrad is an engineer, and I mean, I did like an honors zoology program, which was, you know, it was hard, but I mean, it wasn't engineering hard. I mean, engineers just, it's nuts. It's like, here's your assignment for next week. 150 math questions. Basically, math questions. Engineering, loads, bridge, construction. Like, do it. There's no way. There's no way that one person can really do it. They work in groups. They pretty much have to. And it's not like they don't even like do each question together as a group. It's like, right, you do these 40 questions, I'll do these 40 questions, you do, okay, then we'll get together and we'll just like, you know, staple it all together and turn it in. You're trusting that the other people are really going to do their questions. They kind of have to. It's in your mutual interest. The risk goes up. You can't do it by yourself. That's a risky program, right? By comparison, my honors zoology degree was... easier, right? Okay. What can lead to failures of reciprocal altruism? Well, pretty obvious. Cheating. Okay. If you help somebody out, you know, it's like, and you'll help me in the future, right?
Yes. Yes, I will.
But if they don't, you've been cheated. You've lost out. Now, so you might say, okay, I mean, who wins there? Well, whoever cheated wins. I mean, they get the benefit without having to repay. It's a something-for-nothing arrangement. That's great. Okay. Now, we've talked about what happens if this kind of cheating becomes endemic in a group. The group structure breaks down. There's no point in really being part of that group. I do that. It's not, I mean, if our hypothetical engineering group there that has to get an assignment done, if, you know, people don't contribute to the work, why do it? Not going to have the people in a group. Now, engineers don't get put into groups. They form their own groups, right? So they quickly find out who doesn't actually do a good job or who doesn't take it seriously, who doesn't work, and they won't work with those individuals. Okay. So what's going to allow cheat? What's going to reduce cheating then? Well, societal knowledge, right? Indicating to others who is cheating. That person cheated. Gossip. We'll talk about gossip later. Okay, in terms of language. Could potentially be a big part of this. Who's helping, who's not helping, who's contributing, who isn't, who's shirking their work. Who did you help in the past? Okay, well, no. So societal knowledge. You go, wait, doesn't that require language? Not necessarily. Hey, what about the baboons? They don't have language, right? But, I mean, there's a whole bunch of baboons in the troop, right? I mean, you got, you know, Bob the baboon looking over at John the baboon, making eye contact there. You know, all the other males see, you know, John go off and help Bob. But in the future, if John's trying to get Bob to help, and he won't, well, all the other males see this as well. They don't need to use language, right? It's not like this is happening behind walls and stuff. And it's like... we all saw John help Bob, and now Bob's not helping John. Bob is a cheating baboon. Right? Again, I don't think the baboons are saying it in this way, right? But, I mean, boom, some little neural circuit, you know, puts a tally point against Bob. Bob cheated. It's recognized. It's seen. That's societal knowledge, okay? You have to be able to recognize individuals. I'll help you now, and you'll help me in the future. Wait, who are you again? If you can't tell, if you can't distinguish between individuals, then this ain't going to work. And finally, if there's some sort of selection that can be imposed against cheaters. So if there is a penalty. Well, I mean, in our example of John and Bob there, if now Bob goes off in the future, so Bob doesn't help John in the future, Bob goes to some other baboon, you know, does the eye contact thing, tries to get help. The other baboon goes, yeah, no, you cheated John. I'm not helping you. Forget it. You're on your own. Bob goes back to John. Okay, can you help me? You help me before? It's like, yeah, no. Right? I helped you before. You wouldn't help me. You're on your own, dude. At that point, there's a repercussion for this. Right? So, there's a few things to be thought about here as well in terms of reciprocal altruism, some other issues in terms of where it might develop, when it might develop, and why. If you think about what resources being shared here? Labor, shelter, food, survival. I mean, pulling somebody out of a river or something like that. Okay, what's involved? How much of a cost is it originally to the donor? Right? Is it a really high? Remember, we said the cost needs to be relatively low here. If it's really a big cost, you know, if it's like, okay, I could help you, but yeah, there's a really good chance I'm going to die. At that point, you know, probably your kin-selected altruism kicks in. It's like, you know, I got kids. Or, you know, I might have kids someday. You don't have kids. I could someday, maybe. But not if I jump into the river and try to pull you out and get killed. So, good luck. Bye-bye. All right. So, how high is the risk? What's the size of the population? I mean, if you got a really small group, I mean, the odds are we just got a high chance of kinship involved. So, reciprocal altruism probably less significant here. But what's the risk of, you know, I'll say extinction here, but I mean, basically, what's the risk of the elimination of your group? If you don't help out, will the group make it? Now, remember, this doesn't necessarily have to be group-level selection. Groups are advantageous for the individuals that make them up. If you have these opportunities to assist other group members and you don't, well, if the group breaks up, then, you don't have that benefit, that advantage. So maybe you do reciprocate, even if perhaps you're not going to always get the best return on this, but you got to keep the group together. So these are variables that can influence this. The environmental conditions, we talked about this in terms of behavioral risk already. Variability and predictiveness. The more variable, the more random, the more irregular an environmental is, the more things can change rapidly, the more likely you are have these reciprocal arrangements. What's the carrying capacity of an environment? So, the food resources, if the overall carrying capacity of an environment is relatively low, then yeah, your ability to perhaps find food as an individual may go down. So, yeah, reciprocal arrangements may be good. It's like, yeah, okay, I don't really have a lot of food here. I don't really want to share it with this other person in my group, but you know what? It was really hard for me to find this food, and there's been times when I have not found food, so yeah, I'm taking some insurance out. I'm going to do this now. I may increase the chances here. So what's the benefit then? What's the benefit to the altruist? Long run. Is this a good investment? Okay. Let's take a break at this point here. So come on back in 10, and we'll talk about competitive altruism.